Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. I am joined, as always, by JP. Hey, JP, how you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing very well. How's it going?
It's going really good. Having an awesome week of just great code, good productivity. Life's good. Things are rolling. What about you?
Yeah, I took a day off for the first time in a really long time, and I know we had we had that little winter break, but I was doing a little bit of work there on Christmas break too, so I don't really count that much of as time off by choice, not because I was asked to. I thought I'd throw that little caveat in there.
Nice.
But yesterday I took a day off, spent some time with my sister, spent some time with my niece, went to go see Conan O'Brien. That was really fun, really funny. Highly recommend. That will be my pick, but we'll get into that a little bit later.
Cool.
But yeah, I'm just like in such a good mood. I feel like recharged. I feel like, you know, sometimes your brain needs a break from work. And I had such a hard time. I had to like deliberately not open up my email, and I had to deliberately not open up Slack. And you know what? I caved. I opened up Slack a couple times to respond to a couple messages, but that's just the way the cookie crumbles. That's how my brain functions. I can't turn off. I feel like I need a real vacation at some point, not just like a day off. But I need to plan that, and that'll be like, okay, no code, no Slack, no emails for 2 weeks, and we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, that would be crazy. I couldn't imagine that. Like 24 hours is hard enough to do sometimes. It's weird though, because it is an event, I feel like, when you or I, or honestly any modern programmer probably has like a full 24 hours of like totally off work. And I think like there's a good and a bad, we could probably have a whole episode on this, but like the good part of it is that I think we really love our work and we deeply care about what we do, which is like, that's the really good side about this, is that we find it so fulfilling that even on a Sunday off, like I want to sit and work on code and code stuff and read books and work on some problem set or try to work on a new library and play with it and learn more. But I think the bad side of that is when it starts to feel like obligation or overwhelm, and it's just like this cycle of half output. And so I have recently learned it's so valuable to have at least a good 12-hour window of totally off, no code, step away from it. If you can, get a full day away, because you come back so much more productive. So that's the PSA for today before we get into this chapter.
Yeah, totally. And one thing, two of my coworkers messaged me about, because we have Hack Week coming up in a couple weeks. And,
oh, wow.
And I was like, I have to respond. I even set my Slack to do not disturb. I was away. I was offline. And I like turned my notifications off. But I was like, I have to respond to this. Maybe next time I shouldn't. Like, it could wait. You know, it's like, you forget that things can wait 24 hours. Like, you don't always have to be on call or respond to things like that.
Yeah, for sure. I think as work moves more to instant messaging, it drives that, like, I need a response now, where it's like, oh, that PR review could probably wait 24 hours. It's probably fine. They don't need you to jump in right now. Anyway, okay, yep. So I'm really excited to get into this chapter. We are still going through Refactoring by Martin Fowler with contributions by Kent Beck. We did chapter one, which kind of introduced the whole topic. And then last week we were digging into specific code examples. So this is actually some different refactoring tools or approaches you can take on specific pieces of code. This week gets a little bit higher level again, and we're talking about principles in refactoring. I think that's what the name of this chapter is. It's funny because I wrote down principles in design. I think that's a holdover from my brain from the last book.
Yeah, this chapter actually is titled Principles in Refactoring. So that you got that nail on the head.
Yeah, okay, good. So the first header of this chapter is just define refactoring. What is refactoring? And I feel like the author gets a bit pedantic in just like, oh, well, that's not refactoring and this is refactoring. But let's just read his definition. His definition is an anti-definition away. And he says, quote, if someone says their code is broken for a couple days while they're refactoring, you can be pretty sure they aren't refactoring. And so his whole thing is refactoring is iterative changes that leave everything in a working state pretty much at all points through that process, and iterating reorganizations or just kind of rejiggers of the code is kind of how he defines it. And it's just like, okay, well then where is the line between refactoring and what he calls like a rewrite? What does he call refactoring that leaves something in a broken state? I think it's a bit funny and pedantic, but I think it's a good point overall that if you're approaching refactoring, you should keep everything as active and productive as you can.
Yeah, he brings up this idea of like there's a difference of speaking of refactoring as a noun versus a verb. So you have refactoring a noun, which is a change made to the internal structure of software. So that's like the change, the physical change that you made to the code. And then you could talk about refactoring as a verb, which is the actual act of restructuring software. So your refactor, the noun, has many refactorings, the verb. Or I might have
flipped those. We get the idea either way.
But you get the idea, right?
Yeah.
And then so he has this quote that I thought was worth mentioning because, you know, I guess it does get a little pedantic, but I kind of like it. I'm kind of into it. And the quote's this. It says, over the years, many people in the industry have taken to use, quote, refactoring to mean any kind of code cleanup. Refactoring is all about applying small behavior-preserving steps and making a big change by stringing together a sequence of these behavior-preserving steps. As a result, when I'm refactoring, my code doesn't spend too much time in a broken state, allowing me to stop at any moment, even if I haven't finished. So that's sort of what you're talking about like being in a broken state for too long and while you're rewriting. I guess it's technically, by definition, a refactor, but it's also a huge rewrite. And I think the point more is that like your refactor doesn't have to always be like a huge rewrite. It can just be a tiny incremental change.
Yeah, I think this is just a good lesson in life, honestly. I look at trying to learn to code in my history, and the times when I've taken like a week off to dig into this library framework, I end the week with some knowledge, but it's not really usually very productive. But when I schedule for a month, an hour a day, now that is incredibly productive. And even though it's less time overall, like if you add up an hour a day in a month, it's what, 30 hours? But if I take a full week, it's like 40 hours. I generally take away more in the month. And the point that I'm trying to make is small changes into things oftentimes yield more productive results over time and leave things in a healthier state through the process. So if you're trying to learn something, I would strongly recommend take an hour or two a day versus 20 hours on a weekend to try to learn it. There's times to dig deep into something, definitely. But I think in general, when approaching code, when approaching these types of problems, leaving things in a better state and consistent movement forward is always a better approach than trying to like clear your schedule and like go into the one room. Like we all want to be that genius who can close themselves in the door and write a new framework. But most of us aren't that person and aren't going to do that. And even if you wanted to do that, the way you get there is by putting in the consistent time for years. It's that whole thing of like, how is the lawn so green? And he's like, Oh, all you do is water it and mow it. But you do that for 200 years. That's how you have a lawn this green.
Yeah. Everyone wants to, if you watch Silicon Valley, it's like everyone wants to be Richard, where in that first season, he just goes in, puts his headphones in, you know, he has the inappropriate algorithm that he just like codes all night. And then they have their presentation the next morning and they like are wildly successful. Not everyone can just like do that. I'm sure that wasn't iterative steps.
Yeah, it was not iterative steps. So in general, refactoring, the way he defines it, is these things that leave changes that leave everything in a working state. It's a continuous process. So let's talk about why should we refactor? So what are the benefits we get from doing this? So he makes a lot of really interesting points and things that I never even thought about refactoring, about why it's so important. There's some like obvious ones. It's like, well, it makes your code cleaner, which is like, okay, what does that mean? But he breaks down, like really goes through some specific reasons. So one of the first ones he said is code rot. Over time, a code in a project decays. And I've never really thought about this, even though I totally see that. I've never really thought about the reason why. And he says, well, over time, you're continuously making changes to your code, and some of those changes might be rushed, or some of them might be poorly executed. And then you do that, it's like death by a million cuts. You end up a year later, if you're not intentional about refactoring through that process, you end up with a code base that's just incomprehensible. And I currently manage a code base that kind of feels that way. It was also initially, I wrote the whole thing. It was like one of those dig deeps. But it's the WizTutor code base. I wrote most of what's there for the Rails app initially. And I wasn't, you know, it's not the best code I've ever written by far. It's probably some of the worst code I've ever written. And then over time, a lot of other developers and myself have made changes. A lot of those changes have been somewhat rushed. And so this is just like the worst of both problems, that it was a kind of a negative starting point. But I think even the worst problem of that code base is that there's been changes over time that were rushed or poorly executed, or because the initial code base wasn't self-documenting in a good way, that we're trying to make changes not understanding what code we're using. So we're using code in ways it wasn't intended when I initially authored it. And so that's a really good reason to refactor as a buffer against code rot. So when you're making those changes and going over things, after a year of managing that code base, it should be cleaner and more understandable and more easily changed than it was a year before.
Yeah. And for a second, I want to talk about the ways that your code can rot. I think that might be worth mentioning. And I see this all the time too, is, you know, code can rot in multiple ways. For example, comments. It's very easy for comments to be stale and rotten. And it's like, you read a comment and you're like, how come this, I'm reading this comment and this is like what the code's supposed to do, but it's definitely out of date. And it makes you think like, where did this go wrong? And then you look at the git blame and then you like trace it and you're like, okay, so this PR was made and this comment just wasn't updated. And then so you have to like figure out, you know, you have to track down who made that change and, you know, maybe they just forgot. And it's totally fine because, you know, most editors these days and IDEs will have the comments in like a light gray font. So it's like you almost don't even see them sometimes. So that's one way.
I feel like
way.
It should make them red.
Yeah.
I want to change my coloring to, because like sometimes they should be there, but you should like really see them because they just disappear to me. And it's funny because I submitted a PR, like I opened a PR on one of my projects last night. And I realized like when I was kind of doing a self-review before I was merging that, I was like, oh man, there's so many comments in here all about the way that this gem OmniAuth was handling the OAuth authorization tokens. Uh-huh. And I realized like, by the time it got deployed, I wasn't using the gem. And it was like 8 lines of comments like describing the nuances of using OmniAuth. And I was like, oh, we're not even using OmniAuth. Oh my God. And so it's really easy to happen. And that was in the span of 3 hours that a code comment became totally insignificant. And so imagine over the span of 3 years, how many insignificant code comments you have. I think it goes back to the idea of like breaking up methods and naming them well. Ideally, that's how we're documenting and in our tests versus comments. There's a time and a place for comments though, of course.
Yeah. Another way that I want to bring up how code can rot is like just with variable names. And this is perfect because we talked about in our last episode about how you can just rename a variable and a change like that can be so significant and can clear things up and make things easier to understand, right? Which is like kind of my next bullet point of like why you should refactor. But it goes hand in hand, right? Like all of a sudden you have this variable. Let's say that it's like, I don't know, I'm not going to come up with something on the spot, but let's say the implementation or like the contents of that variable change over time, but you just keep it as a thing, the message becomes skewed, right? So like in our previous episode, we talked about how you can rename variables and what you return from a function, for example, might just be something as general as like result, right? And so that can cover all of your bases, whereas if you had it be something more specific, it might like be inaccurate over time. So I just feel like things like the names of your functions and the names of your variables can be easily rotten because over time the implementation can change and all of a sudden you think it's doing one thing because of the function name or the variable name, but it like stopped doing that 2 iterations ago, you know?
Yeah, and I think that kind of leans perfectly into the next point, which is that refactoring makes things easier to understand. And it makes your code base more comprehensible for others. And sometimes others is me 2 months from now or 3 months from now. So oftentimes I feel like people are like, oh, I don't need to do this because I don't work on a big team or I'm the only one in the code base. But like, you are the same. Like when you jump into that code base 3 months from now, you might as well be a totally different person because you're not going to have all that contextual knowledge when you jump in. You'd like to think that you do, but generally you don't. So making things easier to understand and easier to use in the code base is really important. And I see this every day because I actively manage a few code bases, some of which are really clean, nice and concise methods, no crazy models, everything's broken down really cleanly. And some of my other projects have like these ridiculous models and these ridiculous methods that are so like obtuse how to use them and not well documented and not refactored in a really nice way. And trying to delegate and manage work across these code bases, it's so clear how much more productive we can be just from the initial understanding that the team can have going into this. Because it's like, we need change XYZ that's defined in A, B, and C. As whereas looking at other code bases that are so obtuse, it's like, hey, I need to change this behavior. And it's like, whoa, where do I even start in changing this behavior? So I always have to like stop and record a screencast or write up this giant letter in the issue of like all the nuances and gotchas of this. And oftentimes it starts with a ticket for a refactor so that we can get that understanding to help the developer understand the code and improve it for future, then a separate ticket for actually doing the change that we need to make. And so just the productivity, which is another reason we'll talk through more in a second, but refactoring for better understanding increases everyone's productivity long term. Makes it so there isn't that crazy like learning curve when starting to trying to use an object or a method of or a function of trying to understand what this is even doing.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I want to bring that up later in our next section. You had just mentioned right now a ticket for refactoring. And I wanted to get your opinions on that. But we'll save that for the next 5 or so minutes.
Okay, sounds good.
Cool. Yeah, it makes things easy to understand. I think that goes without saying. The next section was talking about, it's like so glaringly obvious. It's like you should refactor because it helps you find bugs. Mm-hmm. But it also goes without saying, God, we're just like repeating ourselves over and over. But it's like you need tests as well, right? Like you can't refactor to help you find bugs if you don't have good tests in mm-hmm. place. And maybe it's like you write tests when you find those bugs because you previously weren't covering those edge cases. That goes without saying. The last section I have of the why is it makes development faster. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to read these books from the perspective of an engineer because I feel like oftentimes when you have a book about refactoring or a book that has a section about refactoring, there's always this section that talks about how do you get buy-in from your manager because, or how do you get buy-in from, you know, non-technical people who are like, well, I don't see any difference in the product. Mm-hmm. Why are you spending like 2 days on refactoring? And then obviously the answer to that is you need to convince people that by refactoring, the process will get faster and faster and it will take less and less time to do things in the future. Whereas if you don't refactor and you let your code rot, it becomes like a series of patches and like mm-hmm. adding a new feature is like taking out the next Jenga block and putting it on the top.
Oh my God. That metaphor is the most beautiful metaphor I've ever heard. Adding a feature to a code base without refactoring is pulling out a Jenga block from the bottom and adding it to the top. Because that's so true. Like you might be extending the functionality and extending the product, but at the same time, you're making it more and more brittle as time goes on. Oh, mic drop. We should just end the episode.
Yeah, man. And that's all the time we have. No, I'm kidding.
So actually, let's go down the rabbit hole real quick about getting sure. buy-in for refactors, because he had a whole section later in this chapter, but we're on the subject. So let's just jump into that. So, you know, in the context of why should you refactor and when you should refactor, how do you get buy-in from people on your team who are maybe non-technical or just like pushing product hard moving forward? And I love this approach. And to me, it was really game-changing. And it made me realize how many mistakes I'm making with some of the clients that I have, because in a lot of ways, my clients are my managers. So I manage a small dev team. We work directly with clients and I see them as my managers. Like that's how my job kind of works. They're my boss for practical purposes. And I have found myself like trying to justify to a client the need to refactor something. Like, hey, I need to bill you 10 hours to rewrite this part. And it's always a hard conversation. Clients don't want to hear that. And So the way that this author tells us that we should get buy-in from people is just simply don't ask. Don't ask people if you should refactor or if you can refactor. Don't ask permission. And I really took a second and I struggled with this because to me, it's like, well, is that dishonest? I need to like think about my role and what I do. And I want to have good representation and trust with my clients. That's why I've built a strong business and think about what that means. But the way he says this is he said, look, you're being paid for your expertise. And your expertise, if you think in your expert opinion that the best approach to move this code forward is to refactor it, then you should do so. And so essentially, build it into your estimates and make it a part of continuing change. Because I think if you look at refactoring as something that happens in small incremental steps and not something that you need to take 30 hours and dig into and dedicate a team to, then it's a lot easier to approach it this way in the, you know, don't ask, don't tell approach, because when the client asks for an XYZ feature, I can review the current code base and then build into my estimate the idea of like, okay, I'm going to pad this by a good 20-30% because the right way to build this, the way that it needs to be built is to be refactored and then build the feature on top of it. Like, I am responsible for managing my client's code base in a way that keeps the quality up and keeps the code ready for future changes and doesn't shoot us in the foot. And so ultimately, trying to split this into two deliverables to the client and justify and explain them doesn't make any sense. And at the end of the day, my managers in my context don't care about the implementation details. They don't care what libraries I'm using, how the code gets written. Like, they want to know, when will the feature be delivered to their client, that it will be bug free and that it will be performant? Like, what's the price? What's the time? That's what they need to know. And so whether or not there's a refactor needed in that process is my expertise, and that should be up to me. And I am totally changing course on this. And because the idea of billing and having a conversation about needing to refactor is really, like, it's in conflict with what we're learning about refactoring. So it's the whole conversation's moot. It doesn't even matter.
Yeah, it's sort of the picture that you paint, right? Like, the mindset that or like the impression that you're giving. So, like, if you paint the picture that this refactor is, like, kind of this optional thing that we should kind of do, but I'm going to need to bill you 10 hours for it, you know, then it sort of, like, gives, you know, your client the idea, or your manager, that the idea that, like, oh, this is, like, some totally optional thing that we don't need to do. I just want some deliverable. But, you know, if you don't paint the picture in that way, and it's more of like, hey, this thing needs to happen first, like, it like just needs to happen, otherwise this feature won't be delivered, I think those are two very different outlooks.
Yeah, or even hide that feature, to like hide that part of the implementation detail to some degree. And it depends on your role. Like, in my role, my clients don't really care about the implementation details. They want to know they have quality code, that those types of things, but they don't care, like, how we're writing our models or methods. They don't even look at the code generally. They have access to the source code, but they wouldn't even understand it if they looked at it. Sometimes, depends on the client. But it's interesting, because if I think about the context of, like, a contractor, and if I asked a contractor to add on to my house, to, like, add a room to the house, he would have, like, let's say that room that he's trying to rebuild was filthy and full of junk. Like, he would have to clean out the room, get rid of the junk before modifying the building. And of course he would have to do that. He's not going to change the room with a bunch of junk in the room. And that also is things like, probably, I would imagine, maintaining his tools and, like, fixing those things. And, like, there's all things that support the work that need to be done. And so as long as that is an iterative process, like, I'm not going to, as a contractor, I wouldn't bill my client for overhauling my truck. There's a time and a place for doing that kind of work. But at the same time, like, there's all of that work around the work that needs to happen to get this done. And I got to trust my contractor that he's going to do that work and not abuse the billing. And that's all going to be done in service of my job. And I can't expect the contractor to be cleaning in a messy room. And I wouldn't even care. He's like, well, we got to stop and clean it. I don't care. Like, I understand that that's a part of the work that needs to be done sometimes. All right, rant over. But this was totally a mindset change for me that was huge about getting buy-in for refactors.
Yeah, I think that's a good metaphor. Like, the messy room. I think that perfectly sums up, like, the need to refactor before you add a feature on, potentially. The potential need to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so when to refactor, he kind of breaks down some interesting approaches. It's like stuff that you kind of know, but it's nice to, like, give it a label and a name. So when are the different times to refactor? He had like 12. I think I pulled out like 4 or 5 here that I really liked. So one of them was preparatory refactoring, or just getting ready to build a new feature. So before you know you want to make a change, you make a refactor in order to kind of lay the groundwork for that change. And this is something that I've been doing more and more lately, and I've found to be really productive. Is always split up. We mentioned this last episode, but always split up the feature ship away from the refactor, make that two different phases. And so this is just one of the best times to refactor, is when you're getting ready to go for the new feature. Like, that's a part of the work that needs to be done.
Yeah. The next one that I pulled out was comprehension refactoring, which is making code easier to understand before diving in. And I have this quote that I thought was worth mentioning. It's this. It's a common error to see refactoring as something people do to fix past mistakes or clean up ugly code. Certainly, you have to refactor when you run into ugly code, but excellent code needs plenty of refactoring too. And that's the end of the quote. So that's just sort of this mind shift from thinking that refactoring has to be cleaning up quote-unquote ugly code. You know, good code needs refactoring too. You could always improve how well something is, how easily you can understand something, that could always be improved. You know, variable names could always be changed to be better. And yeah, it's just like for your comprehension. And I thought that was worth mentioning.
Yeah, I think it's awesome because refactoring for your own comprehension has the amazing side effect of getting easier comprehension for the whole code base. And right. So it gets that stuff, the insights that you gain, and gets them documented in the code, out of your head and into the code. I think that's an amazing, like, just side effect of refactoring for your own better understanding. The other one that he mentioned, which is interesting that he did, is a long-term refactor. So like a longer or deeper refactoring project. And it's interesting because to me, it's like, well, you said you should never do this, buddy, so you can't have your cake and eat it too. But he says there are times where you're trying to change out a whole library, or let's say upgrade React Native, where there might be a lot of different dependencies and nuances that you need to really dig into and change long term. One of the takeaway he gets there is, you know, when you have that branch, you're making changes, be sure that even through a deep long-term refactor like this, that each small change leaves everything in a working state. And he specifies the nuance of not just up to date with your master branch, but actually working, test passing. And so every single time you're in that code and making those changes, that it's always in a working state, not just up to date with master, but at any point that code could just be deployed. I think that's really important, that if you're doing that, and more I've been doing this with big refactors, that I'll kind of split it up into four or five phases if I feel like this big refactor needs to happen, and I'll just merge phase one to master. Like if it's better than now and all the tests are passing, I merge it and know that we can still make changes. There's this like instinct in myself that's like, I know it could be better, so I'm gonna hold on to it and leave it in this other branch until it's done, even though it's got failing tests. But that's when you end up with a PR that doesn't get merged for 2 months, and it's like, that doesn't help anybody. So it's better to have it better. That's the thing. Like, even if it's just a little better than now, it's always better to get that iterative change in and continue that moving forward. Yeah, I think that's all I had on that.
Yeah, I love that too. I love the idea of, you never want to have a huge gap from my code is working to my code is still working, right? do you know what I'm saying? Because like, you don't want to have a huge gap of like, oh crap, my code's not working, my tests are failing. The longer that you're in that state of, okay, I'm in the middle of this refactor, my tests aren't green, and the app is broken. You know, the longer you're in that, the longer you're in like what I like to call refactor hell, because it seems like there's no light at the end of the tunnel. But if you could just make like incremental steps, you know, it's a shorter amount of time that you're in the red, right? Because you want to get to green fast. And I totally agree with you. My personality is like, I just want to do it all in one fell swoop, and I just want to like tackle this huge thing. But you know what? That is like kind of selfish, because someone has to review that code and someone has to QA that code, and it's, you know, oftentimes not you. And so if you're asking someone to review a 2,000 line PR and asking another person to QA the whole app, if your QA plan is go through the whole app, you know something's wrong. make sure the app's not broken, you know, like, yeah, that's terrible.
I think that oftentimes these happen when you have to switch out a library or a dependency. Like a perfect example is upgrading React Native. And so it's like, once you do that, well, now all my packages are broken and everything's gone to shit. And that's oftentimes what happens. I remember last year, whenever I upgraded to Rails 5, and I ended up in this hell of like things in a broken state for a really long time. Looking back, a better way to approach that could be upgrade each individual gem first, where you can, in preparation, or in the context of React Native, upgrade each individual package first in preparation for your upgrade. So it's like all the different dependencies that are going to break when you upgrade the lower level dependency, maybe bump those first if they still work with the previous dependency, if you can, where you can, do that work. So it's like you've got 10 PRs that each bump one or two gems or libraries or methods or ways you're using things that still works with the underlying dependency, and then bump the underlying dependency. And so instead of breaking 30 things, it only breaks 5. And that's it. You've only got those less to change. So that's one approach you could take with doing that kind of deeper, bigger refactor that needs to be done. Like, think about the things that can be done small. Get those merged, get those live, because it's not good for anybody to have a PR open with 85 files changed. It's just useless information. It's just so overwhelming. It doesn't make any sense to approach it in that way.
Yeah, I've gotten so spoiled because in Opendoor's mobile app, our GitHub repository has what we have what we call a renovate bot. And all this renovate bot does is it bumps our node module, like our package dependencies, like the minor versions. So like it will like submit a PR to bump these versions and then like run the whole test suite. And then like you can just and then you can just merge them in, which is great because although it becomes kind of noisy after a while, because at any given time you might have like 10 open PRs that are just for like bumping the package. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of what you talked about, right? Like you kind of want to have that continuously so that when you do the big React or the big Rails version bump, it's not this like shit, everything's broken because all of its dependencies are broken, and it becomes this like, you know, you're in the red for longer. So yeah, I've gotten spoiled.
That's so interesting. I love that idea of that renovate bot. I love anything that we can do that takes some of that arduous process of having to go through those dependencies and update. And even like in the context of Rails, just running bundle update every once in a while so that you've got the more up-to-date gems is helpful. Because otherwise, if you don't run that for 2 years, when you go to run it, you'll have a bunch of shit break every time, trust me. And so it's better to continuously be doing those dependency updates over time. And so then the last time about when to refactor is during code reviews, which we've kind of talked about. But I love this one because it kind of blends all the different things we've been talking about. So let's say JP writes some code, submits a PR to one of my repositories or vice versa. To take a minute there and do a bit of refactoring helps me comprehend the change that he's making better, helps JP make sure that we're all on the same page of what that change is. And long term, it's kind of taking the best of our minds and getting that into the code base with all the contextual knowledge we have in that state. So it's a really good time to refactor, in my mind, is when you have an open PR for a review. I would just strongly recommend you keep those small or straight up close them if you're going to really do something different. You can still reopen against that branch, but it's like, if you have this PR that sits open for months, it just doesn't make sense to go that way, or even weeks. To me, it's like a PR should be open for a couple days. You both get the information you need, either merge it or close it, and treat it as a new deliverable if you know it needs a lot of changes. That's just kind of like tidbits that I've learned lately that make this easier. But it's a really good time to refactor. You know, you always want to be very respectful of people's code and their approach and seek understanding before you just be like, oh, you dumbass, you should have written it this way. I mean, of course, we never want to be that way. And I think when you refactor to PR, I know that you can run that risk of seeming like, well, all the work they just did is shit and it should be rewritten and they thought about it wrong. So you always want to keep a constructive tone. I mean, I don't want to talk about PRs in general. We could go on and on and on about reviewing PRs. But when refactoring in a PR, it's important to keep those changes small and just like have them be the kind of comprehensional or documentation changes that make it easier to understand and easier to know what's going on.
Yeah, and it's sort of what I wanted to bring up from a section ago is like you had mentioned something about, you know, submitting a PR just for a refactor. And I wanted to get your opinion on whether or not you should, you know, include a refactor in a PR that, you know, updates a feature or adds a new feature. And I think I know the answer to this, which is probably just like, it depends, because that's usually the answer for most
of these
things.
Everything.
But yeah, I feel like oftentimes if I do a refactor in a PR that's updating a feature or adding a feature, it's not what you would consider like a refactor, right? Like, I mean, it's not what I would previously consider a refactor before reading this book. So when I do things like that, I try to, you know, update variable names if it makes things more clear, or, you know, break things out into smaller methods and then write tests for those methods that I'm breaking out these like new methods into.
Yep.
But I guess there is a time and place for only submitting a PR that is just a refactor, which is like, hey, I added some tests, I updated some things.
I think absolutely. And more I've been doing when I define some maybe a little bit bigger refactors outside of renaming a function or renaming a method, outside of those small tweaks, I will, in the PR, when I merge it, create a new issue. And what I've actually been doing is like literally write in the GitHub with the little checkboxes in the PR review of like, hey, here's some things we should probably do long term. I'm going to merge this now, but here's some changes we should make. Do the bulleted list of, hey, break this out into a service object to reduce the model, like all these different things. And then I'll actually use the little create new issue from comment, and I'll actually open an issue at the point where I merge it for the refactors on the change we just made. And so it's like, it doesn't have to happen now. If all your tests are passing and the feature's working, let's get this shit merged. Let's move on and move forward, knowing that we can always submit a new PR for the refactor. So actually, more and more, I've been taking that approach, which is kind of a code review in a refactor, but not really, so kind of a refactor in a code review, but not at that moment, you know, making sure to break out that refactor that should be done or could be done into a new deliverable. And then it's like so much cleaner to manage from a project standpoint. The client gets the feature earlier. And at the end of the day, if all your tests are passing, the code is comprehensible, it can always be better. So it's that always that balance of perfect is the enemy of good. And we want to be shipping great things, of course, but it's never going to be perfect. And we always want to be moving it forward.
Totally. So,
on that subject, when is a time to not refactor? So he breaks it down in this. I love how the chapter is so meaty, got all these great things. And then the when to not refactor has like two bullet points. It's great. I love it. He's such a believer.
Wait, okay. I might have skipped over that section in my notes. When is the time not to refactor?
I love it. So if the code is working fine and doesn't need to be changed, and it's so obvious when you take a second, but I feel like I have the instinct even to want to dig into code and make deep changes just because it's ugly. Just because I'm like, well, this service object is too big. But at the end of the day, we're not changing the service object. We don't expect new functionality to come in. The performance is fine. Do we really need to change this underlying service object? It's like, it's just sitting there working. And so in some contexts, if code works like an API, service object would be a good example. Or let's say, you know, some type of mix-in or module, like you have a big CSS mix-in that's kind of ugly. Like that could be another approach where it's like, oh, I want to clean this up. But at the end of the day, like you're just using it as a dependency and it's working fine and you don't expect any changes. There's no reason to just do that refactor for the sake of refactoring. There's a time and a place for quote unquote, like painting the back of the cabinet that no one sees. Mm-hmm. There's a time to do that sometimes. But in general, like the back of the cabinet can be wood. It's fine. It doesn't have to be blue like the rest of the cabinet.
Yeah. Cool. What was the second point?
Oh yeah. The second one is when it will slow down an essential new feature. Don't refactor if there's a deliverable that you need to deliver. I mean, code I shipped last night is a perfect example of it's not perfect. I know that I can write it better, but I had a pending deadline and literally a client meeting today, and I was up till midnight getting it shipped and getting it live, and it was business critical that we get the feature live. I have test coverage, so I'm very confident that the feature is working well, but like there was a lot of duplication that I could extract because there was these two OAuth integrations that work in very similar ways. So I was like, ooh, I want to build a service object that uses those and inherits them. Like I was like so excited to do the refactors. I was like, this sounds fun. I could do this, but I'll probably be up till 3 a.m. and then the client might not get the feature. So it's like, okay, this is not the time to refactor. I will open, as soon as this podcast is done, I'm going to open a new issue for myself or someone else to like, hey, here's the refactors I know need to happen on this thing. So, and it's that whole conversation of tech debt versus delivery and when is the right time to take the time for quality. So there's a time and a place to ship code that you know full well could be better. There's definitely a time and a place for that.
Cool. Okay, so to recap, we've talked about the what, we've talked about the why, we've talked about the when, and the last section I have, just one bullet point, is on like the problems of refactoring, right? So there are consequences to refactoring, which is like what we talked about. It can possibly slow down new features. But I think the biggest problem of refactoring, and I've experienced this firsthand on my team, is, you know, the longer you work in an isolated branch that you're refactoring on, the harder it becomes integrating with like the mainline, with master. And let's say like you're refactoring and someone else is refactoring, and you think that this variable should be ABC instead of XYZ, but your coworker thinks it should be DEF, and all of a sudden you have like all these little annoying variable changes and people are touching the same code because they're trying to refactor. It gets tough. And so I think a lot of this goes back to the idea of being in red for shorter periods of time. You want to get to green faster and you want to merge things into master faster, and you want to always be iterating quickly, because the longer that you like hold your code hostage in a refactor, the harder it is to merge into master. And you know, you get to the point sometimes, and you know it's bad when you like merge in master, or you try to merge into master, and then like you're crossing your fingers because you're just waiting for that like no merge conflict thing where you have to like colon WQ. You know what I'm talking about? You get that message that says like merge your branch into whatever. And it just becomes like such a pain in the ass when you see that like could not merge automatically. You have, and then it shows you like how many files have conflicts, and you're like, fuck, avoid that. Yeah. So that's like, you know, that's potentially one of the problems of refactoring, especially when you're working with multiple people. If it's just like you and one other person on a project, you know, potentially it's not that bad. But when you have like 5, 6, 7 people, sometimes 20 people working on the same code base, it can become like a huge problem. So it just goes to say, like, maybe your approach to refactoring shouldn't always be like these huge big things. And if you know you're going to be refactoring in your branch, maybe try to get that branch up into master as soon as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. So that pretty much wraps up chapter 2 from a high level. Next week, we'll be back with some more of the nuance of specific refactoring. So we're going to start, again, kind of pick 4 or 5 refactors and kind of deeply go through them so we can try to get more tools in our toolbox of how to approach refactorings. So I'm excited to dig into that. Do you have any picks this week, JP?
Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, not a tech pick, but my pick was... free Conan O'Brien tickets, and you could just like order these online. They're like very easy to get. So I went yesterday in my time off, and the guest was Isla Fisher, which is really cool. They don't announce the guest until I think like the week before, so you can't like get tickets for a specific person. Like, you get tickets and then it gets announced who the guests are. But overall, a super fun experience. If you're in the LA area, definitely would recommend taking some time off and enjoying what's around. Sometimes I forget that like Hollywood is like just like right here, right next to me. There's definitely a lot of fun things you can do, and I love late night television. So
yeah, that's for sure. But check in your city, like what shows are being taped. And that's just a cool hot tip, is that tapings are often free, and a lot of developers and freelancers out there have the flexible schedule to go see one of these live tapings. And that happens internationally too. So if there's like a show, we have a lot of international listeners. So I just want to mention, like, not everybody lives in Hollywood and SoCal, but if you live in this area, for sure, go and check out those tapings. But also, like, Chicago's got live tapings. New York's got live tapings. There's a lot of cities that do these live tapings, and I keep trying to go and I haven't been able to go. I really want to get one. So that's a cool, interesting pick for sure. My pick this week is actually, I've had it for a few weeks now and it's been so awesome, is the Eero Wi-Fi router. And I think just mesh Wi-Fi routers in general, because at the same time, my buddy whose house I visit sometimes, he got the Google Mesh Wi-Fi router, and like I noticed a world of difference in his Wi-Fi. And honestly, like, the hardware that like Spectrum or AT&T or whoever your service provider gives you is complete garbage. One note there, though, even though they charged you $70 install fee, don't throw it away. You have to send it back to them. It will charge you $200 for that box. So I made that mistake one time. Like, I threw away the router because I got a different router, like just the wireless portion of it. And then they charged me for it. So if you do get a new mesh router, don't throw away your old one, which sucks. They charge you for it, which is shitty. But these mesh routers, like, it's not like the extenders like there has been in the past. It's a totally different technology. And it just flies, and you don't get that kind of weird hesitation and lag. And I'm someone who oftentimes is wired in with Ethernet, and it's crazy now not seeing a big difference between wiring with Ethernet and my Wi-Fi, where before there was a world of difference in reliability and latency and consistency. So just definitely would recommend a modern router. Maybe not Eero, as they just got bought by Amazon, which I was a little peeved about. Like, I bought my Eero and then they got bought by Amazon. I was like, great, now Bezos is gonna be looking over my shoulder.
That's cool. I definitely wanted to try out the Google Mesh router at some point, like when I move into a different house or something. But yeah, that's a really good pick.
They make such a difference. All right. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you guys next week.
All right. Peace.